Welcome, beautiful thinkers. This is a beautiful thought. This is how your life is already wonderful. That's the tagline. Staple it on your wall. Remember the truth of that phrase. Your life is already wonderful. There's so many blessings to be enjoyed in life and so many challenges. And we're going to talk about some of those challenges today. This is an interview with my longtime friend and collaborator, Link McElveny, a fellow hip hopper and a fellow spiritual seeker. So he's going to tell us a story about how he was practicing in an ashram in New York State and began to have some health problems. And unfortunately, they spiraled downwards a bit from there. But of course, there's a happy ending. I mean, you could probably imagine. This is the first part of the interview, and you'll hear some of the process of how Link learned to recuperate. He learned some patience and learned some important beliefs or strategies, attitudes that he could apply to his health, how certain things within him were holding him back. So you hear quite a bit about how he learned to overcome those things and the support that he had from his family and health professionals along the way. And if you are in the position, maybe you're in a position where you're facing a challenge and you're not sure exactly what to make of it. Maybe there is some belief inside of you, or some assumption that you're not quite aware of that might be holding you back in some way, just like with Link. Certain attitudes got him into a bit of trouble. So I can offer some help with that using some cognitive behavioral techniques. We can ask, what are the assumptions in this situation? I'll ask you some key questions, which will probably be quite revelatory. Look at your attitudes and collaborate with you to come up with an action plan so you can move forward with some new beliefs that are going to be more empowering for you to help you attain the level of fulfillment than you would really like in your life. So head on over to beautifulpodcast.com, use the coupon code BEAUTIFUL2022, and you'll get 50% off your first session. Now let's hear Link's story.
This is a beautiful thought.
I'm here with my friend Link McElveny, and he's going to tell us a story about having a personal injury, a physical injury, and also what he discovered about himself or about his own mind, his own beliefs and habits by going through this journey. How are you, Link?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, man. It's good. Good to talk to you.
Yeah.
So the story begins when you're in an ashram in New York State. What's life like for you in the ashram?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people have an idea in their mind of what an ashram is. I imagine it's something along the lines of a place where people are meditating and chanting all day, maybe all wearing loincloths or some kind of, you know, what is this, aesthetic bygone era clothing and all looking the same. And being in a state of bliss all the time and only having nice people around.
And, okay.
There's not exactly my experience of living in ashrams and this place that I was at specifically. To paint a picture of it for people, it's like if you imagine working a full-time job, but that job, the aim of what you're doing when you're working that job isn't to make money, and it isn't specifically to produce the thing that job would produce, like a product or, you know, a meal or what have you. The aim is to practice yoga. And
It's like a yoga factory.
I like to think of it more like a yoga university or trade school or something like that, or, you know, right. Internship.
Okay. That's a better way of
putting it. I mean, there was a quote from one of my teachers saying that human beings are just a shit factory. So the factory thing does come up a little bit. But in the idea that, you know, human beings, in our body, we only really produce feces out of our own bodies. But that is usually as an antidote to people, I guess, having a big head about themselves or a big ego. So, you know, that shouldn't be taken out of context. But
I see. Okay. Yeah, that makes more sense.
So maybe there was a bunch of factories within this trade school. So with that aim of practicing yoga, what I mean by that is that in practicing yoga, I don't mean just the kind of yoga that we're used to generally in the West, which is, you know, practicing mm-hmm. physical postures. I mean like the gamut of yoga. So practicing the virtues, yep. Open-mindedness and generosity and equanimity and peace, you know, these kinds of things, kindness. And then also this idea that all of the work that I'm doing is an act of service and that I'm not attached to the outcome of it. I'm not attached to praise or blame. So I'm not doing it for somebody else's approval. And once it's done, it's done. You know, I don't then dwell on it again. And at the same time, the role that I was holding there was, and the role that most people are holding there does have an aim according to the role itself. So, for example, I spent the majority of my time there working in a kitchen and so cooking, and then later on I was managing the kitchen and supervising a team. And so, like, while it's not like you could just say, oh, well, I'm a yogic being and I'm not attached to the outcome, so I know I was going to cook this meal for you, but I didn't, and that's no big deal. It's not like that. I am still meant to cook the meal, and I do everything in my power to achieve that goal. It's just then not identifying with it, you know, and falling into all the pitfalls and traps that we often do. So that was the kind of experience I was having, and you know, outside of the hours of me fulfilling that role, we call it seva. So it's selfless service is seva. So outside of the hours in which I was working in that way, there was meditation and there was chanting and there was study groups and, you know, all sorts of the kinds of things that people might usually attribute to an ashram. And it was a very beautiful place.
Beautiful how?
It was on a property in upstate New York that was like just naturally beautiful. Like it was kind of like in a bit of a foresty area. There was a beautiful lake. There was animals like outside of my room. I lived in the ashram and worked in the ashram. So outside of my bedroom window, there was quite often deer, like families of deer just, you know, grazing and stuff. Like it was gorgeous. Wow. Like it was a super beautiful place to live. It was, you know, a couple of hours out of the main city of New York and, you know, not too far from smaller towns and stuff. But, you know, you can imagine that, you know, just the less noise and the niceness of being out of the city. So
how big is the ashram property approximately?
It's pretty big. I don't know how to describe things in terms of hectares and stuff, but it's big.
it's fair enough.
Like, I don't know, to walk from one side to the other would take me maybe like 15, 20 minutes, I guess.
All right.
And that's from one of the properties, and then there was a second property, you know, further down the road. But yeah, so it's a very large place.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question saying thank you. So doing the service, is it expected that other people will say thank you for what you're doing, or is it expected that they won't, or there's no expectation around that?
That's a really interesting question, actually, because so from my understanding of how to, I'm going to say this in a, I guess, a poetic way, how to be a wonderful human being, appreciating the people and thanking them for things that they do is a great thing to do. So there was a lot of appreciation and gratitude and thanks in that way. And it sometimes felt a little bit strange when people would thank me for the service that I was offering because it wasn't the point. So it does create a very interesting feeling. And I still haven't like come to terms with that and really balanced that within myself. Like that's maybe something like a lifelong kind of thing to work out and understand deeper, because all of these things, the beauty of this place is that these weren't things that I just practiced there and then I leave and then I'm changed and I don't have to think about them anymore. Like it's set up in a way that is very similar to the kind of life that I would live outside of the ashram. So it's all training for my life and I will just continue to practice these things now. So I still think about that. So is there an expectation? I guess like culturally, yes. Like, people would thank each other for things. But again, like with these kinds of things and with this place in particular, like there's a culture within the community and there are teachings from the school. And then there's a way that each person personally practices. And those three things cross over, but aren't necessarily the same, you know? Yes. So, so it's a pretty deep question. The best answer I can give at the moment.
Fair enough. But what would you say if somebody says, thank you, thank you for the beautiful meal or whatever it is? What do you say in response? Do you just say my pleasure or?
Yeah, I would usually say you're welcome.
Yeah.
I have in the past often said my pleasure. Funnily enough, though, these days I kind of avoid saying that. I think these days I've got some hang-ups about physical interaction and sexuality and stuff like that that I haven't resolved within myself. Okay. So when I say my pleasure to somebody, sometimes I get a little bit worried that it has weird connotations to it. So I just start saying it. Like I used to say
fetish of doing service with people.
Yeah, and it just, like, I don't know, it just created this vibe. Like, again, like, I've got weird hang-ups, about this stuff. And this has got, this isn't really so much to do with the ashram and the teachings of the ashram. This is just something from my own personal life in that I guess I spent a lot of my life, using physical touch and affection or craving physical touch and affection and having that being one of the main ways in which I express love and affection to people and build rapport with people. And so while that's cool in a way, like I'm not like against it. I just, for me, have gotten to certain points in my life where I have tried practicing a different way of doing things. And so to see what effect that has for myself and other people, because maybe there's some weird habits in there that aren't what they seem. They're not just about expressing affection. And also I've had situations where I have, I would say, cultivated attraction in other people that I didn't want to be there. And I know you can't really control other people. So, again, maybe this whole this whole direction that I'm moving in is futile as well. But there were just situations where in which I gave people a certain impression and and on reflection, that was a conscious, deliberate thing that I did. It happened on a subconscious level, but I didn't need to do it. And there's another way to be a loving human being that doesn't do that.
Yes, yes. Well, that's a fascinating question. I've been wondering about that a lot lately because I wonder – like when I see somebody do something that appears to be flirting, I'm like, how conscious is that really? Like, do they even know they're doing it? And in some cases, if I mention it, then they seem to have no idea. It's very fascinating.
And whether or not they actually have no idea or it's, something to do with the way they want to be perceived.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, but in some cases, I believe them. I think they actually had no, they didn't have a clue, or maybe they had a clue, but not the full picture, not even most of the picture.
And also, I guess, culturally, there's just a whole bunch of things that we would do and our community does that, I guess, whether or not they're expected of us, they're, in quotation marks, normal. So, to have them pointed out might sometimes be a bit weird in itself. And I guess we're unusual in a way. Like, there are a lot of people these days that you can access through podcasting and cool communities and stuff who do like to explore these things and talk about these things. And I think sometimes being mostly in those kinds of situations makes me forget what it's like for people who are more immersed and living in culture, like the greater, I don't know, standard narrative culture. So, like to some of these people, it might be more strange.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It sounds like we're all kind of aliens wandering around. The people who are willing to ask deep questions were foreigners in this land.
Perhaps. I don't know. I haven't met everybody, but I'm getting the impression that maybe it's something like that.
Yeah. So you mentioned a few times about culture in the ashram. Mm-hmm. So, of course, it's based in the US, but it also comes from an Indian tradition. So how did those two things interact?
Well, yeah, in really strange ways. I'm just trying to think of a way to answer this question that's okay, well, this is really interesting. And actually, it does apply. So, there's this idea of that Americans tend to have a tendency to overwork.
Okay, yep.
And there's this thing that's called burnout. And so, I have this tendency myself. And in my life in Australia in the past, I've done this thing where I've gotten somewhat obsessive about being productive. So, I will, like when I used to rap a lot, I would go over rhymes in my head in every spare moment that I possibly could. And so, I was running my mind all the time intensively. And if I ever felt that I had a moment where I wasn't running my mind, it was like I was wasting time and going to miss some kind of opportunity. And that led to like serious mental disturbance and anxiety and imbalance. Like it was not good. And so in the ashram, one of the things I got to work on was this thing. So I had a full-time responsibility, and that responsibility was to, you know, nourish people, like to feed people. So I had a responsibility to their health in that way. And then I had a responsibility to a team that I was managing that was, you know, it's a physical task. And when you've got a situation where people are not only working, but they're also wanting to offer themselves as much as possible, because the idea of selflessly serving, like that's a really interesting concept. Like, my understanding is if you can treat your entire life as an offering to humanity or to God or to the self, you know, the universal consciousness, or just any kind of benevolent act of generosity and charity or what have you, if you can offer everything you do in that spirit, it's immensely liberating, and it creates a profound sense of peace and joy. Because it's not about you, and it's not about what you're going to get out of it, you know. So, so to develop,
That would have to include rest, I assume.
Exactly. Yeah. So in this environment, we were strongly encouraged. In fact, it's kind of like a requirement that people, you know, are given the autonomy to follow themselves. It's not like somebody would come to my room and say, have you gone to sleep yet? You know what I mean? That I wasn't policed and monitored in that way. It was just assumed that if you're going to be here and offer yourself in this way, you're going to need to go to bed early. You're going to need to rest on your rest day and not, you know, do whatever it is that would drain your energy further, you know? And I, at some points while I was there, I did that quite well. But I have habits of staying up late. I have habits of eating ice cream and chocolates and stuff late at night. I have habits of wanting to go out and, you know, just do things in general. And they're cool. Like, in, you know, entertainment and stuff like that, that's a part of life and romantic relationships and all these kinds of things. But I knew going into this situation that, that it probably wasn't going to be a good idea to try and entertain and indulge in a bunch of those things and fulfill the role that I was taking on. But instead of doing that, what I did was I fulfilled the role as much as I could. I maybe even pushed myself harder than I was being asked to in terms of the amount of hours I was keeping. And I didn't go to sleep early and I didn't, and sometimes I ate ice cream and chocolate really late at night. And I burnt out. So, and I could say that's part of American culture. I could say, this idea of serving selflessly might lead one to want to give oneself completely regardless of their health, physical circumstances, but that's just not true. Like it's very, like you said, a part of offering service and a part of living yogically is taking care of yourself. and it's, and if the outcome's not, if the outcome's not the aim of it, then there is no situation where in which you would make the decision, I'm going to continue to burn myself out because I've been asked to do this thing and I'm going to finish it, rather than saying to somebody, I'm not able to do this. Or, you know, it's not going to happen on time or whatever. Maybe I'm not a good fit for this role, whatever the thing is, you know. So, my inability to do that consistently, and I did do it sometimes. It wasn't like I didn't do it at all. There were times when I did all of those things, but I didn't do it enough to take care of my health. So, I got really stressed, and I, in the past when I was in overseas, when I was traveling, I got parasites, like digestive parasites. So, and I had those treated when I returned to Australia and recovered from them. But I had had periods of time in the past where I lost heaps of weight and I got quite skinny because I was doing like a parasite cleanse and taking herbal medications and eating really strict diets and stuff like that. But when I was in the ashram, I didn't feel that I had any parasites when I moved there. And for a few years, I lived there for almost 4 years in the end. For the majority of that time, I was doing fine. But then in the last year in particular, I started to develop these symptoms again of like intense gas and bloating and stuff like this that would particularly happen at night. So it would really affect my sleep. And it was just this vicious cycle of basically becoming more and more afraid of eating in general. So I got to a point, like before I moved back to Australia, I was 49 kilograms. And for those who know it in pounds, I mean, I'm not sure if we want to do the conversion quickly.
It's like 110 pounds.
Right. Okay. So it's, yeah, it's very, very underweight. And I'd gotten to that point because, like
how tall are you? You're like 6'1".
5'11". I'm just under 6.
Okay. Yeah. So like 175 centimeters, I think. Something like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, definitely severely underweight for your height.
Exactly. And that was a result of me eating smaller and smaller and smaller meals and eating dinner less often and stuff like this to try to deal with these symptoms. And also not being sure, like I thought maybe I had some kind of parasite again. So taking sorts of medication, but also trying to still, you know, fulfill this role and so on and so forth. And it just wasn't tenable. So I had to leave the country to come back to Australia to be in a situation where I could just focus on my health.
Makes sense. How did your peers react?
Like in the ashram?
Yes.
They were really concerned.
Yeah.
And okay. Yeah, like they strongly recommended that I move back to Australia and focus on taking care of my health because, clearly I wasn't doing that there.
Well, it seems kind of sad that you would leave the ashram in those circumstances. What do you think?
I mean, it wasn't the way I wanted to leave.
Yeah.
At the same time, I wanted to move back to Australia maybe a year before this, but I had this opportunity I had a visa that would last up to 5 years and what have you, so I had an opportunity to stay longer and I wanted to make the most of that opportunity knowing that I might never go there again. And
right.
And yeah, even though I knew that it would have just been probably a lot easier like to go back and take care of myself back home, and also there's just things that I wanted to do with my life, the idea of doing something that I didn't want to do was also good practice, you know, and seeing something through and sticking it out, you know. In my life, I've given up. I've given up at different points in my life when things got challenging. So I wanted to see if I could, because again, if I could overcome these things, if I could take care of myself and speak up and fulfill this role and do all these things in this very challenging situation, then I would be able to do that in other situations. So, yeah, again, looking at this whole experience as a kind of training, yeah, I wanted to see it through. And I guess the idea of failure is really interesting because I generally don't like failing at things. And I read this book, Black Box Thinking, recently that really helped me change the way I think about that, in that failure is one of the primary means of achieving success. So, you generally will need to fail multiple times, maybe continuously for years at something until you're able to develop that skill or develop that technology or product or overcome that tendency within yourself and change a habit. So, failure is actually great. It's a good thing. It's how you learn. But at the time, it was also very, for my ego and my identity and the way that I perceived myself, it was really difficult. I wasn't able to do what I wanted to do.
Right, yeah. So you get back to Australia. How does it feel?
Like a relief to be back with my parents. It was not ideal. Like, I mean, I had a dream of coming back from the ashram, looking great, feeling great, having learned a bunch of new life skills, being a very much more peaceful and calm yogic person, and be able to just serve my parents and take care of them and, you know, get a good job and be an independent person and podcast and do everything I wanted to do. And instead, I was an emaciated, psychologically disturbed, dependent son. And I was then, I was, you know, living at my parents' house, freaking them out. Like, just the sight of me. Like, my parents had to see me. Like, you got to understand, I was emaciated. I was literally experiencing the symptoms of starvation. My bone marrow was being eaten away. I developed osteoporosis. My white blood cell count had dropped really low. Most of the muscles in my body had atrophied. So, like, lifting my legs out of a vehicle was challenging. Going for a slight jog, like breaking into a jog to catch a tram, felt like I had cement blocks on my ankles. to add further challenge to the situation, in the LA airport on the way back to Australia, I went to stretch my wrist. Well, basically cracked the knuckles of my hand. So I went to crack the knuckles by placing my hand on the ground, in a sort of upside down reversed fashion and pushing back on my fingers to crack the knuckles at the base of my fingers where they meet the palm.
Yeah.
And when I did that, due to some restriction and tension in my arm, I damaged something in my arm and created some kind of a nerve situation in which I developed this intense nerve pain. So, while I'm traveling back, trying to lug all these bags around and things, it was difficult to use my arm. While I was in the airplane, there was only one position that I could lie in that wasn't painful to try to sleep. And then I spent 2 weeks in quarantine in a hotel in Sydney. So, mind you, the whole time still dealing with this digestive thing, in which I was still afraid of eating everything, getting bloating at night, trying to pack this bag and throw away this sort of stuff and condense things while I couldn't lift objects with my right arm, my dominant hand. It was brutal. The whole thing was just ridiculously brutal. Coming back to my parents in that state, sucked. It just sucked massively. my mum was super scared and afraid. And my parents thought that the place that I'd spent the last few years in was just some dangerous cult that had
like these stories you hear about Scientology or something.
Exactly. That this place had nearly destroyed me. And in one sense, again, not wanting to completely break their trust in my ability to take care of myself, it was difficult for me to convey to them that I'd essentially done this to myself. Yes, the situation where I was in was not ideal, but I was an exceptional case. There aren't many people who come back from this particular ashram in the state that I was in. You know what I mean? Yeah. So, I'm not aware of anybody else myself. So that was difficult because, yeah, they what had been one of the most beautiful and personally developing experiences of my life, what I learned there and what I was able to, the way that I was able to practice on a deep spiritual and personal level was incredible. It was something that I would absolutely do again. Even with the challenge that I faced towards the end, I would do it again for sure.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
But I couldn't convey that to them. All they could see was this very difficult situation that I was in. So, it sucked. I was really sad. While I needed to be taken care of, I needed my dad to drive me around to places. I needed them to help me cook sometimes, and I needed their financial support. They also in some ways needed me to support them. There were times when my mum was crying and she just wanted it to be over. She just wanted me to just start eating more and to put on weight and to do it quickly. And my doctors were telling me at the time that it was important for me to gain weight slowly. There are some complications that can come about if you gain weight too quickly. Your body can go into some sort of weird shock thing where it does not good things. Funnily enough for me, I was able to gain weight reasonably quickly and not experience those issues. But at this point, we're a week or two into me coming back, and it was likely to take months for me to regain the weight. So just having to assure my mum that this is okay and it's going to be all right, I'm going to recover from this. While I had recovered from a similar situation in the past and I had faith in a sense that I could, I was also in some sense afraid that I wouldn't, I'd never been in this situation before. That was challenging, but kind of cool in a way, and my mum watching me meditate all the time and do these things that to me were quite beautiful, to her were disturbing and a waste of time and just a sign that I was silly and stupid, because she doesn't really like religion in general. So
which things other than the meditation was she seeing you do?
Chanting, I guess.
Right. It's a beautiful practice, but if people don't know, then it just seems very strange.
Yeah, it just seems like cult-like behavior.
Yeah.
And again, that's what I mean. Like most of the things that I do in my life are associated with cult-like behavior. I won't say most, but yeah, some of the things that are the most important to the deepest goals I have for my life, like having a peaceful state of mind, being content, feeling a sense of purpose and meaning for my life. You know, like these activities are generally considered to be silly wastes of time by a lot of people.
So how did you resolve that conflict or that tension with your parents?
Well, it was interesting. Like there was one time when I spoke to my mom about it. We were talking about meditation and I just responded to her honestly with a kind of confidence, just saying that, you know, that meditation is, it's a really good thing to do. Like, and, you know, like when she was really upset, it wasn't rational. It was emotional. So, so the way that I think I, rather than so much what I said, the way that I said it. And I guess, it was honest. It had a kind of conviction to it. And it was empathic. Like I clearly cared that she was afraid and I acknowledged that she was afraid and, you know, just hugged her and said it would be okay. Not in a, like, placating way, but in, like, the most genuine way that I could. But then on a more greater way, like in terms of the bigger picture of the things that we disagree on. I mean, they're not resolved. They'll probably never be resolved. But the less that I'm concerned about her agreeing with me or validating me or approving of me, the less it matters. you know, she's my mum, so she's probably always going to be worried about me and always encourage me to do things that she thinks I should or shouldn't do in a way that might be considered nagging or critical and criticizing or whatever. You know, it's like they're not generally considered good techniques of persuasion or encouragement, but that's her way of loving me in her own way, right. You know, like, so, again, if I don't take it personally, then it doesn't matter. If I do take it personally, then I make it worse. Basically.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's an important concept about getting along with people. We can interpret the way that they show affection, even though it on the surface it doesn't make a lot of sense to us.
Yeah. And we want them to be different.
Yeah. So what happens next? Like you just it's not so simple. Like you just gain the weight and build up strength and then there you are. It's not that simple.
In a way it's not, and in a way it is. So basically I came back to Australia, started seeing a very good acupuncturist who prescribed me some really good herbs to help with my digestion. I went on a mental health care. My doctor was awesome. Actually, my GP was great. Like when I went and saw him for the first time, I just sort of explained my situation a bit and I'd been kind of trying to hold it together for my parents. And I saw him and I just explained what was going on and just started crying. And he just really acknowledged what I was going through and how difficult it was. And he was great. He just said, can you just eat like pasta and meat, like bolognese or something, like carbohydrates and meat, and just eat something? I was like, yes, I can. You know, like I just needed somebody to tell me to do it, you know, like for whatever reason. I needed somebody to guide me. But he really, really took care of me, like in a way that I don't know how common this is amongst GPs. I've experienced it a little bit, but not like this from a GP. He's quite special in my experience. And He just took care of me. He put me on a mental health care plan, recommended that I see a psychologist. There's a program you can go on if you have an eating disorder, where you can get psychology subsidized and also to see a dietitian subsidized. And I also went on a physical health care plan for my arm, the issue with my arm, and saw a physiotherapist. So, yeah, just tackled it from all angles. And just systematically started eating more and more and more. And
But before you saw the GP, was it like you were still fasting because you had the preoccupation about the parasite, or what was going on?
I wasn't fasting so much in the standard sense. It's just that sometimes I wouldn't eat dinner because I was experiencing symptoms that day or the days leading up to whatever, and I wanted to sleep that night. And I was just eating very small meals, very simple, like brown rice and two kinds of steamed vegetables and some avocado. Anyway, so I just started to eat. I introduced things systematically in controlled ways on a very scheduled way where I was attempting to eat 5 to 6 meals a day, like so 3 larger meals and 3 snackier meals. And that kind of structure and things, even though that also has a kind of pathology to it, to be that kind of rigid, it was really helpful at the time for me because I didn't have to try to decide what to eat. I already planned in advance what to eat and I could just follow that. And that was very helpful. So, yeah, I did that. The acupuncture and the herbs helped a lot. And over the course of 2 months, I got back to about 70 kilos, and my standard weight is 65 to 75 kilos. So I essentially returned to my standard weight within about a month or two, which is much quicker than I was asked to or I was encouraged to, but I didn't experience any issues with it. So it was fine. And as I introduced things, it became more and more apparent that the food itself often wasn't the reason why I was experiencing symptoms. It mostly had to do with stress, how much I was sleeping, and physical tension through my abdomen. So the intestines themselves were being restricted by muscular and connective tissue, what they call fascia, tension through my abdomen. So there were various like physical exercises that I could do to release tension through there and just release mental tension in general, and that would often have a significant effect. And then, you know, when I started eating cakes and stuff again, there was a pretty clear pattern that when I would eat cakes and things consistently for days, after a period of time, I would start experiencing some kinds of symptoms again. But I never really again experienced the severe symptoms that I had when I was living in America. So and it, like, I still don't know if what I had was the kind of parasite that was like, that needed to be dealt with, that needed to be eliminated from my system, or if it was just opportunistic, you know, organisms in my digestive system that when I was
getting out of balance. Yeah.
Exactly. And particularly when I was, my health was not good, they would, it would get worse. So, yeah, basically, you know, 2-3 months after I got back, I was back into training jiu-jitsu. I was working in the garden again. I was riding my bike heaps. I was swimming a lot. Physically, things were, you know, really coming back again for me. I was doing great. Just about to start working again as a shiatsu practitioner. And our jiu-jitsu training. there was a technique we do where we get thrown onto the ground, and the way that you throw yourself on the ground out of this technique is that you go into like a forward roll. And so I attempted this, and I hadn't done this technique in a while. Like, it had been maybe 5 years since I'd last attempted it. And I tried it once with my partner, and I did it really badly. And I was like, that felt really awkward and wrong and doesn't seem right. And so I was going to ask my sensei how to do it properly. But then we looked over and we saw another pair of people doing the same technique. And I thought, oh, okay, I can see how I'm doing it wrong and how I'm supposed to be doing it. Okay, cool. let's just try it again. I won't, you know, bother my sensei with this for the moment. Like, I'll just do it, and feeling some sense of, I don't know, wanting to impress my partner and myself and whatever it was.
Yeah.
I decided to do the technique again. And I drove my collarbone and all of my weight into the ground and snapped my collarbone. Like badly, the distal end of my collarbone. Mind you, at this point, I didn't know that I had osteoporosis at this time. I hadn't done the bone density tests, but
I guess you wouldn't even think about that. I mean, you're young and, I guess you weren't healthy at that stage, but it's something you think old people might have.
Well, that's interesting. Look, like, I definitely was aware that my bone density was compromised. So whether or not it had come back by that point, I didn't know. I'd already been advised to get a bone density test, which I hadn't done yet. So when I did it, with the shock and everything, like it wasn't really that painful. So, I was kind of hoping that it was just like a dislocation or something like that. And I looked at myself in the mirror and my shoulder was just like completely, asymmetric to the other one. Like it was dropped. Oof. It was really dropped. And I went out and I looked at it and he's like, oh, maybe it's, you know, I think he was trying to give me some positive potential ideas of what it could be. You know, maybe it's, this or that or whatever. But at the end of the day, other than a break, anything else that it could have been, like a dislocation or whatever, like I should have been in extreme amounts of pain. Like it would have been really painful. So I, again, out of some desire not to want to put people out or whatever. And I'd borrowed my friend's car because I was going to buy my friend's car off him, but I'd borrowed it to test drive it. And I was like about a 45-minute drive away from my house. So I just go out to my car and with one hand try to get to like a clinic or something to see if someone could like pop it back into place. But it was late. It was like 9 o'clock at night or 8 o'clock at night or something. So there was nowhere open. I had to go to hospital. I had to get an x-ray. And so I decided to stop by a kebab caravan on the way home because I didn't want to go to hospital without having eaten dinner. So I got a kebab, went home, ate my kebab, got a taxi to the hospital. I'm in the hospital till like 3 a.m. before I got the x-ray results, and the doctor comes in and he's like, yeah, it's broken and you need you need surgery. So that was terrible news. And I discovered quite quickly that all of the kind of contentment and happiness and feeling good about myself and all this stuff that had come back to my life was really, really dependent on my physical functionality and the idea that I was about to move out of my parents' place again, and all these things that I wanted to do were just taken away instantly again. And that was really hard, really hard. Like it had been challenging throughout and I'd cried or I'd had difficult things, but it was like a slower build up and a slower decline with the previous situation. With this, it was just like from really good to terrible in one night. I was really disturbed or disappointed in the fact that my spiritual foundation did not, I wasn't able to,
you didn't have as much equanimity as you thought.
No, like in a really difficult situation, it wasn't enough for me to feel good, you know, to have detachment from it, to have my value as a human being not be to do with this physical stuff, to be able to accept really challenging circumstances. So it made me think a lot about growing old, you know, because at some point I'm going to get old and I'm going to die. It's likely that my physical body will deteriorate, my ability, I will become dependent again later in life. So yeah, it was just unsettling.
Yes. Well, I've heard people say this. I think they said it in the audiobook, what's it called? The Science of Enlightenment. The teacher says, what are you going to do when the earthquake comes? That's something that his teacher used to say to him. And it's a little, well, I think about that, but I think, oh, I don't want that. You know, I don't really want something like that to happen, but inevitably it probably will happen to each one of us in some form or another.
Yeah. And of you know, a dear friend of both of ours spoke to me one day and he shared this idea of 100 battles, 100 victories.
Oh, okay.
And this will be my paraphrase version, and apologies for not delivering it in probably its most beautiful form. But what I took away from it was that, you know, when I went onto that jiu-jitsu mat in that dojo, like, it was a dangerous situation. I didn't ascribe it the kind of respect it deserved. And therefore, I allowed myself to injure myself, and the consequences were great. You know, it was a very, very small, simple mistake. It was the kind of thing that I could say to myself, that was unfair, you know? Like, it's unfair that I'm punished this much for this small little thing, you know?
Right.
But that's life. Like, and I was listening to podcasts and music while I was riding my bike, you know? I was sometimes doing that just while walking around in general. I mean, one day I was listening to something in headphones and I was just like, I just stepped onto the road to check if a tram was coming or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even think I stepped onto the road. I just kind of got close to the road. And as I did this, a car almost hit me, right?
Right.
And it turned out one of my ex-girlfriends sends me a text message and she's like, did I just almost hit you? Or like, it was weird synchronicity. But like, not that I think she wants to hit me with a car. It was just this weird situation where, like, that one tiny moment of, like, it wasn't like I was being super unaware. I just had one of my faculties slightly away, and, like, I really nearly did get hit by a car. And in that moment, I was just waiting for a tram. You know, like, there's nothing... It wasn't the dojo, you know what I mean? But in this way, if I can approach my entire life from this sense of mindfulness and that at all times, not to be scared, you know, not like I need to be on alert that I could die at any moment, but just that I'm aware all the time, then I'll know when it's appropriate to switch into, like, this might be dangerous mode. And that can happen at any moment.
Yes.
And it should be pretty obvious when I walk in the dojo.
Right.
And even in the dojo, you know, like, there's degrees. Because, like, when I'm not doing the technique, I'm relatively safe. Like, it's very unlikely that I'm going to get hurt. But as soon as I'm doing the technique, I need to step it up to full, you know, full consideration mode of danger. Mm. So
yes. Yeah, I try to think about that when I'm in the kitchen, because it's like, you pick up a knife. Sometimes you don't even think about that. You're like, you know, it's just a utensil. But this can really hurt you. You know, you make the wrong move and you might end up with a trip to the hospital.
Exactly. And it's not just about preventing injury. The mindfulness itself generates a kind of experience that can lead to bliss. And
right.
So, like,
absolutely.
Yeah. So it's funny. Like, it's that thing, I guess they say about how practice, it's the means and the goal, you know? So, like, when I can flip it around in that way, when I'm chopping vegetables in the kitchen, I'm not being mindful just to not chop my finger. I can actually have a lot of fun while I'm doing this task. And train, you know, it's cool. There's a really cool way to look at it. And I think this 100 battles, 100 victories kind of, heads in that direction in some way.
Hang on. I'm not entirely sure I understand the concept. 100 battles, 100 victories.
No, and I don't expect you to from my explanation, because I don't think I can explain it very well. And I guess I encourage anyone listening to this to maybe, like, look into it and check it out.
Okay.
Because I hesitate to try to explain it right now because I don't think I'll do a very good job. But
okay, fair enough.
But I guess it's that a really simple way that I'm thinking about it right now is that Oh, no, I'm not going to bother. but I think maybe
okay.
from what I'm saying in terms of maintaining mindfulness in all situations, I think some of the effects of this idea are things along those lines.
A beautiful thought.
Link refers to that saying, 100 battles, 100 victories. I was doing some research and we asked our friend about it, and I have some notes to share about that phrase. So it goes back at least to the times of Master Sun, the author of The Art of War. It's not clear from my research if Master Sun originated the expression or if it was already existent when he was writing his classic. But Master Sun refers twice to this saying, and he says, if you know yourself but not your enemy, you will have one win for every loss. If you don't know yourself nor your enemy, you are likely to lose every battle. If you know yourself and your enemy, 100 battles, 100 victories. And the other reference is when he says, 100 battles, 100 victories is not the epitome of war. The epitome is never having to fight. And many people will recognize that in those references from Bruce Lee. For example, in Enter the Dragon, where he's on the boat towards the island for the fighting tournament, and he convinces an impetuous fighter to go onto a rowboat with the promise that he'll fight him on one of the nearby islands. And then he has this guy tied to the main boat, unable to board because he's on this rowboat in a difficult position. Lee never has to fight. These are the kinds of things that a skilled and intelligent fighter will do to avoid battle. I mean, it doesn't even have to involve deception like that. I remember once I was in Newcastle, Australia, with my friend Luke, and we looked on the train as we were standing on the platform, and we noticed there was a fellow who looked like he was in quite a disturbed state of mind. And we said, let's go on the other carriage. And Luke said, you know, if this were 5 years earlier, I probably would have gone in that carriage, and probably there would have been some friction between me and that character, and we might well have got into a fight. And I said, well, that's real self-defense. We observed the situation and we avoided the confrontation. And that's partly what this expression is about, because it's not just the battle that counts. If you want to have 100 battles, 100 victories, it's not just when you're in the heat of war that you have to be prepared. You have to be prepared well before that. You have to know your resources, know your circumstances, know the terrain, know what's going on around you, exercise perspicacity. So you know how this works. Then if it does come to entering into battle, then the concept is be prepared to win. Have the mentality to win. Or Sun Tzu says in another passage, he says something like, victorious warriors win first and then go to war. Our friend said to us, it's so interesting because a lot of the time people will be extremely nervous about situations which aren't necessarily life-threatening, for example, public speaking. But every day we might do something like be in control of a one-ton vehicle which has the potential to kill us and others around us. That might sound a little grave, a little morbid, but it's the literal truth. A lot of people will drive their vehicles without really considering that they have the potential to do severe, injurious damage to themselves and others around them. So perhaps we should be aware when we're driving, when we're riding a bicycle in the street, when we're handling a knife, even when we're in the bath bathtub in or in the shower, because a lot of people actually die by tripping over in the shower. That's true. You can get into a lot of trouble that way just by slipping the wrong way. So let us be aware of our surroundings, aware of the potential dangers, people or things that might harm us. Know perhaps even where the exits are, like in that scene in The Bourne Identity where he still has amnesia and is puzzled about how he knows so much about the people's backgrounds that are sitting around them and which ones would be willing to fight or know how to fight. We can know this stuff when we pay attention to our surroundings. Another note about that interview, there's a story, I can't remember exactly who tells it, but there's a story where a man is traveling in Asia and he decides to go to Tibet to a certain monastery and he says, well, surely the people there are so well-balanced and take care of themselves and they're so spiritually advanced that there's not going to be anybody there who would annoy me or who'd present any difficulties. So I better bring this troublesome chaiwala, that is this tea boy or this tea servant from India to Tibet so he can bother me so I have a chance for spiritual development. As he found out, even when he got to the monastery, there was no shortage of people who lacked spiritual development or who had some annoying habits. So I guess we can always find something to annoy us, right? If we look. So the point was, just like with Link in this interview, he says, oh, you know, we might imagine this ashram, people chanting, meditating, everybody living in supreme bliss. It's not quite like that. So when we say, oh, well, these people have it easy, these monks have it easy, or they are removed from the world, I don't really think that's true. I don't think there's any way to be removed from the world, even when we are practicing in some place that is literally or physically, geographically removed from the world. It's not really the case. It's not like these people aren't facing aspects of life that we have to face living in society or living as householders in a city. So I thought that was interesting. Thank you for listening. Remember to jump onto the Telegram group. You can head on to beautifulpodcast.com and use the link at the top, the socials link section, and book a coaching session with me. You'll get 50% off your first session using the coupon code BEAUTIFUL2022. And we can start to explore what's going on in your life, what's going on inside you. I can teach you a little meditation and we can begin to form an action plan on how you can improve your life, your relationships, what's going on around you. Think about how you can react differently or how you can think differently to those annoying circumstances, those chaiwalas of life. And yes, please use that coupon code BEAUTIFUL2022. Have a wonderful day. Oh,